this is Matthew Putman, and you're listening to Utility Function. Today I had a chance to speak to somebody who was as far away as anybody during the time of this pandemic, Peter Singer, who is in Australia. I think many of you know who Peter is. He was an influence on me, and I think on many of us. Many people credit him as the world's most influential living philosopher. And I believe it. And in my home alone, I have several of his books. He has really been credited as the founder of the modern animal rights movement. I find that Peter is provocative often, controversial sometimes, and I think really has us thinking about our own ethical responsibility, not just to animals, but certainly to people. He's the Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University. He's a laureate professor at the Center for Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics at the University of Melbourne as well. I think that his career starting really in the 1970s, but with the Animal Liberation book in 1975, made people think about veganism almost for the first time. I really loved this conversation. We dive into many things, both in Peter's past and how he's facing some of the ethical dilemmas that we have right now. Please enjoy. Thank you so much, Peter, for coming on this. I think that this interview would have been different a few months ago. And as much as I want to look at things in a universal way so that it lasts and people can listen back to this and think it applies to them at that time, do you think that it's impossible to avoid a conversation right now during COVID times that involves our perspective of COVID times?
It's certainly difficult to avoid it. It is the dominant thing that's happening in the world right now, and it gives us a different perspective, possibly a short-term perspective, relatively short-term. I think that the larger issues like climate change, for example, are continuing and are actually more serious than the pandemic, serious as the pandemic certainly is. So I try to get some perspective on this, but sure, it's a dominant issue now. So if we're talking now and if people are listening now or within the next few months, then they'll be interested in this topic.
Definitely. I'm not going to dwell on that. So I'm kind of getting it out of the way, although it is really hard to get out of the way. So I at least wanted to put it through, a lens, which all of us, we will be seeing this stuff. But I had a friend who is a huge climate activist, and I'm only saying this, you brought it up, is a huge climate activist, kind of well-known guy. And he said to me, I went out to his country house and we were going for a swim. And he said, I can no longer go out right now and talk about climate change if people don't care about the generation ahead of them and whether they live or die. How do I possibly think they're going to care about it 100 years from now or even 50 years from now? Do you connect with that feeling at all?
Well, I can understand that people have this attitude, but I do think it's worth reminding people that these other problems are there, that they're larger problems, that large as the pandemic is, climate change has the potential to cause much greater death and devastation, homelessness, and a variety of other problems like that. So I think we have to keep reminding people that, this is going to pass, and we will get back to maybe not exactly where we were before. Maybe there will be a new post-pandemic normal, but it's not going to be so dramatically different as it will be if the world's climate gets seriously out of control. We pass the 2 degrees Celsius barrier. We have, all kinds of unpredictable developments with climate, and we have very large numbers of people who become climate refugees. I think that's a much larger and more dramatic, even if slower to unfold, kind of event than the pandemic.
Oh, I mean, I certainly agree with you. And I think my friend would too. It's more of a question of, it's something that I think your work deals with a lot, at least the way it's touched me. And I think is the human instinct is not so good sometimes, right? Dealing with numbers is often how I think of things when I look at your work. And I want to, throughout this conversation, dig a little bit deeper into that. But this is one way of saying the numbers of lives that will be affected by climate change is more ultimately than the lives of COVID. This is getting over the human instinct to care about the lives around you or at the moment seems kind of a core issue.
Yes, that's right. That is a core issue in my work. And it's obviously true with my concern about global poverty. It's true. So that's a question of distance. It's one of the things that I started off. The example of the drowning child in the pond in front of you, whom we would all jump in and save, no matter, you know, how expensive the shoes we were wearing were, and we wouldn't worry about them being ruined because this child is here in front of us. On the other hand, when there are people on the other side of the world who we don't see as identifiable individuals, then we're not so ready to save them, even at smaller cost. So that's the geographical distance. Then when you come to climate change, of course, you're talking about discounting the future is a large factor there, the fact that the people are not present, but they're going to be there in 50 years or 100 years. That doesn't grab us in the same way. And also, I think with my work in relation to animals, although some animals grab us, and we see that because when people think about cruelty to animals, they think about cruelty to dogs and cats in particular. And if you look at the amount of money that people donate for animal welfare, it's overwhelmingly dogs and cats. Although, you know, they're a tiny percentage of the animals on whom we inflict miserable lives. When you compare it with pigs and chickens in factory farms, but we don't see them, we don't care about them in the same way that we care about dogs and cats because we often have them living with us at home.
Yeah, no, I this is definitely the impact I think you've made on so many of us is to stop and think about the equivalent intelligent being that is a different one than is sitting on your lap and you're petting. Or to think about a child that is not next to you. But right now we have a sense, clearly it was before the pandemic, and you know, we were closing borders, for instance, we were, you know, entering trade wars. Like there was a distancing and a sense of starting to go on even before. And I don't want to be political about that. It's just something that was happening, you know, and suddenly we're forced into our homes. And, you know, then our world gets smaller and smaller. And you do kind of, you know, we all have this desire to hold on to our kids, right? If my child is right next to me, it feels right in such a way that it feels to me like right now harder to break that barrier. Can you give us a hint of how we could do it? You know, what ways could, in a time of feeling isolated and wanting to, you know, care for those really close to you, can you think about those farther away?
Well, firstly, I don't think we should be too hardline about this. I think we should accept that, right, humans are mammals, and as mammals, we care for our children and our close relatives and those with whom we're in close relationships. That's something that we've done for millennia, and we're going to continue to do that. So even though there's a sense in which ethically we ought to be more impartial between people who are close to us in terms of being kin or physically close to us and those who are distant, we have to understand that very few people are going to be so purely driven by ethical imperatives as to place the stranger, you know, to the children of strangers on the same level as their own children. So I don't think we should demand that, but I think what we should talk about is, you know, the fact that we don't have to do absolutely everything for our children. Our children are basically going to be pretty much okay for most of us. And when I say us here, I suppose I am speaking about people living in affluent societies who are middle class or above. You know, what troubles me is the fact that we feel that everything that we have ought to go to them or to go to us and them, and virtually nothing should go to those who are far away from us, even though their needs might be much greater. So that's why I'm encouraging people to take smaller steps, to think about donating 10% of their income to the most effective nonprofit organizations they can find, to think about eating an ethical diet, because we don't need to eat animal products, or particularly factory farmed animal products. You know, those are all steps that people can make without sort of sacrificing their children to save the two children of strangers. You know, that's a sort of philosopher's question, but not the real world one.
Right. So you actually, the full ethical, if we could break from both evolution and some societal norms, the true ethical thing would be to say our children will be fine, give 100%. But since that is so against us, at least do something.
Yeah, that's right. Do something. Try to raise the standard of what's normal. You know, 10% is reasonably substantial, but it's for most people, it's not a sacrifice. In fact, I'd argue that most people will feel better about their lives if they're giving something like 10%. It'll be more fulfilling. Their lives will be more meaningful, and the kinds of consumer goods that they won't be buying because of that 10%. Don't really have any major impact on their lives.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting how. My instinct about myself is, you know, I'm trying to update constantly, but I think about how you have. And by the way, I ask my son this question. So the other day, I have a 9-year-old boy. And I was at the breakfast table and we were eating bagels, and I asked him, you know, if there were a starving child, because I wanted to ask him, knowing that I would be speaking to you, this question, you know, would you, you know, the guy, you know, we live in New York, and there are people that you know, ask for money for bagels, right? I mean, it's a real thing. Or you could take that money, you know, the same amount, and get, I mean, I gave your scenario essentially to my 9-year-old, and he was really trying. He said, well, could we get, you know, he really wanted to divide this, right? How mm-hmm. could we take it and buy half a bagel and give half of it? And I was amazed how early that instinct. To me, I thought that since I was speaking even of a generic human to my 9-year-old, he would say, give the money to that would last longer elsewhere and make a bigger difference. And I don't blame him for it. You know, like you said, there's something that I want him to be empathetic towards his neighbor. You know, but at the same time, the logical thing, the rational thing to do is what you're saying. If, you know, but I still didn't want to break my son of it. You know, it's a strange thing, you know, that we deal with. And I think we should kind of cope with all the time and figure out at what time what's proper, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I don't think you can live, you know, worrying about every small expenditure. I don't think that's a good way to live. You know, should I buy my son this ice cream, or should I give the $5 to effective charity? I think it's more a matter of it's more a matter of thinking, well, I'm gonna what's the percentage I'm gonna aim to give, and then I'll give that this year, and then we'll see, you know, how much I have left for the things that I need for my family.
Sure.
You know, if it's easy, then sure, then you can raise the percentage next year, and find something that is significant, but that you're okay with.
Yeah. Okay. So I think about the fact that when I grabbed your book off of a couple of your books that I have on my bookshelf and wanted to, you know, reread the parts of them and check up on them before I spoke to you, I realized that, you know, 25, 30 years ago, I was reading these, or 25 years ago, and they have a big influence. And you have this huge influence on a lot of young people, or a lot, you know, this is and not just young people. I didn't mean that, but because I was young, I'm saying it. You have an influence that people will take what you say and live their lives according to what you do, what you say. Yeah, big responsibility, right? I mean, I realized this as I was reading it. My God, you know, when somebody's words start to become that, it's almost messianic, right? And that's what is it?
I don't like that messianic term, please.
You don't feel that people might see your work like that, first of all?
Oh, I do recognize that people are influenced by my work and that they change their lives in what they eat, in you know, what they give away, sometimes in their career choice. I think that's terrific because I think it's, if I'm encouraging people to think, then that's what I want to do. And if they end up thinking in the way that I do, that's fine too. It's just, I just objected to the term messianic because of all the sort of salvation, save the world kind of stuff, which is obviously.
I don't mean that you would say that, but it's possible that you could have, you know, disciples. It is feasible. I mean, whether you like it or not, right? I mean, it's like, but anyway, more to, less to the point of the bad word to use, but has there been something that you have updated on yourself that you would like to go back to and say, you know, maybe somebody's stuck on something that I wrote 25, 30 years ago, and I wish I could correct it?
Well, in terms of the things that people are likely to use in how they live, no, I don't think there's anything I want to correct about the sorts of changes that I've urged people to make in their lives. So, you know, for example, I've just published this short book it's coming out in the US with Norton called Why Vegan, which is really republishing some of my writings over the years on an ethical diet. And it goes right back to 1973, the first New York Review of Books piece that I wrote on animals. And then through the book itself, and then up to some, in fact, one the last essay is about the COVID pandemic. But so I was looking through all of those pieces in order to select them. And you know, there were some things about the language that I wouldn't have used anymore, but in terms of the content of what I was saying, I still think that this is basically right in that area, that I haven't changed my views on the fact that I think we ought to be avoiding animal products and particularly factory farmed animal products. I've added, obviously, the concerns about climate change and food, which I was not aware of in the 1970s. So there are things that are added, but yeah, there's not really anything that I want to take away of what I said then.
Okay. I'm not saying you should. I wasn't looking to bait you for something. I just, you know, views change and I realized your power over people's thinking. But what does change is technology throughout time. You know, I'm the CEO of a technology company, and you know, I do this as a way to have an excuse to speak to people like you.
Right.
But technology has changed and does all the time. I mean, we have potentially vegan, vegan meat, you know, and there are a lot of things to look at that. We also have technologies that may allow a type of philanthropy that you don't even realize you're doing. I mean, there are interesting technological changes that have happened. What interests you or excites you about sort of modern technological advance that didn't exist before?
There's lots of things, and you know, obviously,
yeah, please, pick a couple and we'll dig in.
Yeah, well, communication is clearly, you know, we're doing this now, I think it's, you know, imagine what this pandemic would be like if we didn't have instant communication through the internet. We would be far more restricted, and my work would grind to a halt, basically, whereas as things are now, most of this I can keep doing in one way or another. I'm in Australia, but I'm teaching my classes in Princeton because the campus is closed for physical students, but I'm teaching remotely. I've got access to all the libraries and digital documents, everything that I need. So, you know, that sort of that possibilities of the internet and the knowledge that it brings, the fact that more or less any question that comes to my mind, I can find an answer for. That's fantastic, I think, and you know, in particularly in my areas, but I think for anybody really, global access to knowledge is a tremendous thing. And even though that's slightly mixed, because it's also global access to non-knowledge, to lies and distortions and mad conspiracy theories. Nevertheless, it's a tremendous thing, and I do believe that in the long run, it's a major source for progress.
Yeah, I'm wondering about the thing. So even in this example, a lot of things are, how do we solve problems? I mean, you're a kind of philosopher that is, it's very applied in a sense, right? I mean, this is, there's action we can take that goes beyond reflection. I think about sort of centralized technological choices and then these sort of local things. I mean, you're in Australia, I'm in New York right now, and we're still local, right? I mean, it's not as good as us sitting together. I really don't believe. I mean, I still think this is a pretty big sacrifice, to be honest with you. But not as big me talking to you as if we were speaking other languages, if we looked very different, it would be even more a bigger sacrifice than if we were together, if you know what I mean by this. You know, there's we don't need a universal translator. These larger things, you know, we're speaking the same language, we come from similar, it's different, and we can have empathy for each other in this way. You know, I'm wondering, I feel like that we make decisions as humans, and we can create technologies that bring us together in ways that involve a level of connection that make it feel local in the way that I want to give to my children. But I don't know what those are. Do you feel that that's a technological challenge, or do you think that that's still a philosophical challenge that can be dealt with just through changing your way of thinking?
Yeah, I think that technology actually helps us to change our way of thinking and helps us to relate to people who are different. It's true that, you know, you and I have much more of a similar background and can relate much more easily. But I think it's going to come that the technology will make it easier for us to relate to people who are not so close to us and to understand their situations. For example, in the philanthropy field, there are organizations that are using this. There's one of the effective charities that I recommend and that is recommended by The Life You Can Save, the organization that I founded, is called Give Directly, and it gives cash grants and in some cases like a universal basic income, a monthly small amount, to people living in poverty in rural East Africa. You can talk to those people essentially. You know, they're online. They're telling you in an uncensored, unfiltered kind of way how this makes a difference to their lives. So it's not quite the same, but I think it does bring us closer, and it can help to build relationships between people and between groups of people in ways that we could not really have done without the technology.
Did you, I don't know why I thought about this, but did you like science fiction when you were young?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I haven't read much of it lately, but yes, there was a period when I went through a lot of science fiction.
What did you like? I don't know why I'm asking this, because I love science fiction. I'm just curious. I remember
Robert Heinlein, for example, the time travel ideas. Who else? J.G. Ballard. John Wyndham, the Day of the Triffids and Crake and Wakes, those stories.
They create a world you wanted to see. I can be very simplistic about myself and say I'd like to see a Star Trek replicator. Like, I would like that. I would like the world to have replicators You don't have the problem with animals, you know, and animal rights. You don't have a problem with global warming. You make something atomically precise and you ask for it. And it comes. I mean, I can just say that and say, yes, I was inspired by Star Trek to do it. Right. It's not deep sci-fi, which I do like deep sci-fi too, but
yeah.
Is that a world that you would like to create in?
I don't remember that kind of sense of that sort of world. In fact, you know, some of it, of course, was worrying accounts of how worlds might go wrong. That was a worry. But some of it, I suppose the time travel stuff fascinated me when I was young. I mean, that idea of being able to go back or forward in time was a wonderful idea. That's something that technology hasn't achieved and probably can't achieve. But you know, that was a nice idea that I liked anyway.
Is there a time we could have gone back and changed the trajectory? Like, can you think of an event that would have changed the trajectory to us either not consuming animal products or not causing climate change? Is there any?
The animal products, I think, so I don't see that was a choice that we made. I think that was how we evolved. We evolved from omnivores. As Jane Goodall has shown, chimpanzees will catch and eat small monkeys and other animals. So I don't think there was ever a choice about eating meat. And in that sense, there was never a particular moment. In fact, it's rather the present that gives us more opportunities to live well and healthily and nourish ourselves completely without eating animal products, which may have been true for some humans in some particular geographical locations, but hasn't been true for our species as a whole until now. Well, still isn't now, but is true for large numbers of people in more affluent societies. So I don't think there was a moment about that. In terms of climate change, you know, I suppose you would really have to think about the Industrial Revolution and the use of coal to drive the Industrial Revolution, and you would have had to stop at that point to not go down that track.
Would you have the trade-off to the potential lives lost from not having industrialization?
No, probably not. I think industrialization has brought a quality of life and a security of life that is far superior to that what existed before the Industrial Revolution. So, no, I don't want to go back to a agricultural society, let alone to a hunter and gatherer society. So I accept that. But now the thing is, can we control this? Can we still have the benefits of the Industrial Revolution without the catastrophes that climate change could bring? I think the answer to that is yes, but it requires a sort of, as we were talking about before, it requires a commitment to the future and a commitment to others that doesn't fit very well with the sort of more selfish human nature that we have evolved with and the more narrowly focused human nature.
Yeah, it goes then. I do have this, and I think a lot of people probably do, of when you feel incredibly confident or incredibly happy that humans are as good as they are. I mean, you know, we don't walk down the street and just kill each other all the time. We don't rob each other. I mean, people do some good. You kind of live in that sort of Steven Pinker idea that things are getting much better, or Matt Ridley, or all these people that I really respect. And then I also have a sense, though, that, you know, human nature won't get us to Peter Singer style altruism in some regard on an individual kind of libertarian way. And if not, then you could say, well, it's okay that my son would, even if he would say he would not give something, if we take some individual circumstances and try to centralize them. And that, and then that has its own danger. So you say, what if humans never, for climate change, for instance, you say if humans will never conserve enough, we'll never be that good at conservation. So we maybe want to enter into a large geoengineering project, for instance. or we want to allocate natural resources in a different way through centralized governments. And that goes against my instinct of how humans behave, because I think this is the big question of how do we get there in, you know, if you say effective actors, what's the most effective and efficient, I guess, way to get to these big things?
Right. So I think it's true that, say, climate change won't be solved just in a libertarian way by leaving every individual to their own decisions, because this is a classic case of market failure. This is a case where there are externalities. We are passing costs on to third parties who are not part of the transactions. And, you know, economists who are somewhat laissez-faire recognize that you need some interventions to remedy those market failures. But the intervention doesn't have to be sort of tight central government control. It might be something like a carbon tax or a cap and trade scheme, which controls the externalities, passes on prices in the costs of the externalities, and then you can let individual behavior under that arrangement go ahead, and we will still be able to deal with climate change. Perhaps at the global level, you do need some sort of arrangement so that all nations are contributing in this way. We don't have some nations that are being free riders, as you know. Basically, the Trump administration wants the US to be a free rider on this. So we need to have some constraints about that. But again, it doesn't have to be a sort of totalitarian global government. It can be international agreements of the kind that were reached in the Paris Agreement.
Right. Or you could have, I mean, now you have a huge separation of like the income divide, or you'd say, and forget the income inequality and just go with a few billionaires. You know, you probably have a couple billionaires that could engage on a geoengineering project without asking anyone. If they would do this, then it clears up climate change and nobody else has to think about it. But you're a philosopher. I'm wondering if that is a good idea or a bad idea, not from even a ecological standpoint. Let's just picture that it works. And everybody goes about not thinking any differently. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I'm not sure.
I am a philosopher, but I'm a consequentialist philosopher. That means I judge actions as right or wrong in accordance with their consequences. And if if the alternative is that we don't control climate change at all, and we end up with a situation in which we have hundreds of millions of climate refugees who have to move because the climate has changed, they can't grow food where they used to grow food, and all of the conflict that fuels and other disasters. And if the only alternative to that is that these handful of billionaires get together and successfully pull off a geoengineering project which works and has no untoward consequences, which is of course a huge risk with anything like that. If you ask me that as a hypothetical question, then I'll say yes. It would be good for the billionaires to do that.
It's the moral imperative of the billionaires to do it.
Well, it would be a moral imperative, as I say, assuming that they really know that they can pull it off and that it won't backfire. And this is, to me, this is, you're referring to the idea of instead of democratic processes, you have a handful of very powerful and rich people doing this. That is a problem in general, but I'd be prepared to swallow that. What I'm having difficulty in swallowing is the idea that they can know that this will work, without the negative possibilities that it goes wrong and produces something that's worse, or simply doesn't fix some of the basic problems, like how is geoengineering going to stop the acidification of the oceans caused by the additional carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? So you need to have all of those problems solved.
Right. It may not solve all problems, but if it solved a really big one.
Yeah. If it solved a really big one and avoided the hundreds of millions of people becoming climate refugees and so on, I would take it.
Then they or anybody who has the power to, whether it's governments, individuals, or whoever, has that responsibility then to move on to ocean acidification, I guess, right?
after that, yes.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. I mean, I do think about power dynamics a lot right now. You know, it's power dynamics when there's not a war going on in a way that it's an obvious war is interesting to me, right? Like there's feelings that, you know, there's a trade war going on clearly between the United States and China. I mean, it's an all out trade war, tariffs, and the supply chains have been disrupted. That's kind of an act of aggression. There's kind of a civil war in the United States, but it's not full out, you know, but there's a feeling of civil unrest to the point where so these sort of almost wars give us this interesting chance to reflect and try to figure it out in ways that I don't remember happening in my lifetime. I mean, it was easy to be opposed to bombings, you know, it's really easy for me to stand up against that and not see any. And especially for me, who just doesn't like the body count of war, right? I don't know how you feel. It's like, you know, I can, you're into numbers. I can look and say, no matter how good Obama was in many things, if there was a drone attack somewhere that killed people, he's responsible for those people that are killed, right? But when you have these sort of soft things that are waiting in the wings to be deadly, it's an important time for us to be thinking about this stuff. And one thing that can be very deadly is climate change. You know, it's the same kind of thing. And I've been thinking about these power dynamics a lot and certainly wondering how you think about them. I'm going to jump to something entirely different, completely different, but something I've wanted to ask you for a while. I am completely with you and have always argued completely on the side that if we have any rights as humans, it should be to have a way to take our own lives in which is dignified and not judged by society. That euthanasia should be something that it's cruel for it not to be allowed. First of all, do you still feel that way? I assume, but from your previous comment.
Yeah, absolutely, I do. Yes, and in fact, you know, that's one of the issues on which I think we've made a lot of progress since I first started thinking and writing about it. Because in the 1970s, that was not legal in any jurisdiction in the world. Now it's legal in many places, a number of European countries, which is increasing because the German High Court earlier this year said that that laws against assisted suicide were not constitutional. In the United States, of course, where more and more states have joined, the whole of the West Coast and Vermont and Hawaii and now New Jersey are allowing medical aid in dying, the whole of Canada. So this is something that I think is spreading. And I think, in fact, that spread is going to be pretty irresistible in many countries. Some of the more religious states may hold out longer, but I think it's coming more or less everywhere. People are no longer so worried about the slippery slope. That was the big argument against it in the 1970s, that, you know, once we allow some killing, then the states will start killing off those that they consider racially or politically undesirable. Nothing like that has happened, right? We've had open euthanasia in the Netherlands for 40 years now. We've had it in the state of Oregon for 24 years. There hasn't been this slippery slope, and I think therefore people are more comfortable with it than they were, and that's very reasonable.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. And the slippery slope argument was always a bad argument, I thought, as well. We were talking about personal choice, and the only thing that people should, you know, if you lose the choice of this, you know, and you're not compassionate as a society in this way. But there are other things that seem unrelated, but I've had a couple personal experiences lately that make me feel, or people I know, differently. Something else that's becoming more available or legal is psychedelics. And I know that this may seem unrelated, but psychedelics are often the reason, you know, these programs that make and research that has led to legalization of certain psychedelics are very much of a dealing with trauma and dealing with suicidal tendencies. So you have, and it's often the same states that have euthanasia rights that are having, for instance, you know, ketamine or MDMA legalized. And so you have, I find you often have the same people asking in great despair, having this question of, do I go to a ketamine clinic or do I go to a euthanasia facility? Do you put those two together in your mind and think about that ever?
No, I haven't actually made that connection. I guess I'm, you know, very aware of people who are using the medical assistance in dying legislation and who or are interested in that, or situations where they're inquiring about it. I don't personally know anybody who's in that kind of situation who's thinking about using psychedelics. Though I've read about it. Obviously, I've read Michael Pollan's book about that and seen various other things. So I'm aware of it, but seems to me that it's still a much more a kind of minority thing. And you know, it could be very useful, particularly for people treating people with depression. I've seen that's encouraging because depression is such a huge source of suffering in the world. And anything that gives us a real hope of treating the depression cases that are currently hard to treat. You know, some cases we can treat, of course, with the drugs that we have. But anything that provides us with opportunities to help the people who have forms of depression that have so far not responded to treatment, I think that's a terrific benefit. And I welcome, therefore, the research and the more open research into use of psychedelics for these purposes. But as a kind of alternative to euthanasia, I'm not really aware of that. It would be a nice alternative, I guess, if it worked.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's really amazing. So I just spoke to somebody, and I mean, this isn't a question, I'm just talking, but I spoke to somebody who we have a mutual friend, and this friend was going to a euthanasia clinic in Europe, and was sort of last minute convinced, listen, try a ketamine clinic. And, you know, certainly you have a right. Will you try, you know, being on an IV infusion of ketamine, you know, just what's it hurt? The person so far, it wasn't that long ago. The person may still end up with whatever choice that person wants to have. But it was fascinating. I hadn't thought about it either, the two things mm-hmm. being linked. But you know, with ketamine, you have this experience of being dead, essentially, you know, it's a completely, you know, you go deep. I mean, the point is like, this is what they use to put you out for surgery, right? You're as close to that experience as possible. And then you pop back, right? It's like one of those things. So how do you like it? You know? And I'm making light of it, but it's not actually light. It's kind of interesting. Right. And,
But when you pop back, are you back in the situation where you were in pain
I'm not an expert. I'm certainly not an expert. But, I mean, there's, as you said, I mean, there's research on it that some would say, yes, that it does. Some say, I think that there's a lot of more research probably that needs to be done. And honestly, I'm no one to talk about it, but I'm not an expert. But I find it fascinating. I mean, and... The more you, I mean, and it's sci-fi again, but you know, if I look at, I think it was a Werner Vinge book, Rainbow's End, where a man with starts to wake up, and it was one of these situations where he had Alzheimer's, severe Alzheimer's, and then medical intervention came and they woke him back up, and there he is in a new world. what can we do to wake ourselves up becomes interesting to me. And again, this isn't a view that, oh, you're going to regret it. It's not that. It's just fascinating for me to think about, you know, choices we make. And it's okay to make a choice, you know, in any direction, you know, but it's fascinating either
way. Sure, I agree. You know, and it's good for people to experiment and find out what works. Otherwise, we, you know, maybe there are benefits in things that we would never find out about.
Right. Right. So, you know, I don't want to take your time forever, but there's something really simplistic about your work that is like consequentialist, as you say, and at the same time, harder to do sometimes, you know, I mean, this is true with a lot of the things we've discussed with, you know, animal rights, giving to those that you haven't seen rather than those that you have, and all of the things that are the basics of your early work, or even maybe work, even things that you've talked about regarding COVID, when talking about the young versus the old, you know, there are a lot, your work always does this thing that makes you think you get it and can act on it right away because you can, but that it pulls against human nature. I'm wondering right now, how good of a job are we doing now at being able to be our rational selves versus our instinctual evolutionary selves? How optimistic are you? And when I say now, I really mean right now, not a year ago.
we're not doing very well right now, I suppose, but. No, look, I think it's always a matter of just trying to do a little bit better. It's always a matter of improving the gradient. I mean, there's no doubt that, you know, Jonathan Haidt has this idea of we're the rider on the elephant, and basically the elephant is sort of moving ahead. So that's the rational part of us that's the rider, and it's but. You know, any control that it can exert is beneficial. I think that, you know, I suppose one thing, if you really want to know how we're doing right now, is you look at the polls for the presidential election. They're a lot better than they were 4 years ago. That is, it seems to me that people are resisting the appeal to our baser emotions that Trump was using to get elected. And, you know, we shouldn't forget that he was elected by a minority of American electors even then. I'm hopeful that he'll be rejected by a much clearer majority of American electors in 19 days or whatever it is. If so, that'll be a sign that we are more open to influences from our rational selves than from some of these baser sort of xenophobic, self-interested appeals that Trump relies on.
Oh, God, I wanted to let it go on that question, but first of all, we kind of would have to time travel 21 days or something for us to make sure you're right. But you're right; it's looking that way. But I also, what if? I mean, God, you know, I should just let that be positive and let it go. But there is a thought that I have. If your family wasn't sick and dying and you weren't blaming that fact on a response to COVID, what is it our baser instincts in that way? Or is it still go back to this personal connection to people around you more than somebody you don't know? I mean, most people don't know Donald Trump, but they probably know somebody that's been afflicted with COVID by now.
Yes. So to some extent, that's true. And it's sort of a reality that, you know, you remember when he was downplaying it, and now you realize that he was wrong about that. And therefore, you blame him for the fact that the United States has dealt so badly with this. That's true. Okay. So, you know, there are other, a variety of other factors, I think, that make me think that we're not doing as well as I'd like, but we could be doing a lot worse, that we're not going down the worst paths, that people sometimes do go down in crises. And, you know, that most people are responding sensibly to the pandemic. Certainly not all, but, you know, it's the kind of situation that you can get all sorts of crazy ideas around. It's kind of economic problems that, say, led to the rise of fascism in the 1930s. And although there are signs of that happening, I think that we're going to resist them better than they were resisted in Europe in the 1930s.
You think we'll resist them due to human rationality?
Well, I think it's playing a role. It's not the only thing. You know, it's also true maybe that we don't have the sort of mass millions of unemployed people really in desperate circumstances that happened during the Great Depression. So we manage the economy better. But I think, you know, all of that works together because if we can provide for our basic needs, we're less desperate and we're more open to more rational thinking.
So you sound pretty positive, but also a bit concerned in some ways too, as I think we all are right now. But maybe I'm getting that wrong. I hear you. I mean, I tell people that truly, if they ask me how I'm doing, I said, well, you know, right now I feel this way, but if you speak to me in a couple hours, it might be very different. And I you know, I'm prone to this type of thing, but in the last few months, it's been more true than ever. And I think that I don't have a question about human nature so much. I mean, I do think that people are okay and we're, you know, but when we get to a level of the way that you consider this about how we look beyond those nearby or the obvious choices that will benefit those, not even ourselves necessarily, but those that we see and instinctually want to take care of, it becomes really difficult and really difficult right now. But the way that we'll do it, I think, is by looking at work like yours and continue to remind ourselves. I mean, it is really good to go back to and to constantly check ourselves. Am I different today because of this than I was in my rational beliefs before this?
I'm encouraged by, you know, the number of people who contact me and say that they have been influenced by my work on these issues and they have changed their lives. And it shows that the possibility is there, that human nature has those possibilities for doing quite remarkable things, you know, including people who've donated a kidney to a stranger, for example, which I find harder to do than donate cash to strangers. Those kinds of things I find are encouraging. Sorry?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. I'd rather earn a little bit of money and do it than, you know.
Yeah.
I'd miss a few meals rather than I'd miss a few kidneys.
Yeah. Right, yeah. So, you know, those sorts of things. Changing your diet is another example. You know, I actually took part in a controlled study, I think the first ever controlled study of the effect of a philosophy course that talked about the ethics of eating meat. And we were able to track students' consumption patterns at the university cafeteria according to whether they'd been in the class that talked about the ethics of eating meat or been in the otherwise identical class that talked about something different that week. And we found that it did change their behavior, that there was a statistically significant decline in the purchase of meals containing meat. So, you know, that was encouraging. It shows that this does work to some extent with, you know, obviously not, it's not like the whole class stopped eating meat or anything like that, but there was a drop. And so I think there's lots of grounds for encouragement in thinking that our reasoning ability plays a role here.
Yeah, I mean, there is this thing, though, I'm getting out of this back to the technological idea, is that how much we try to influence thinking or just provide a solution. You know, if there were a lab-grown burger, you know, like it's still protein, lab-grown, and we could just do that. We do. I mean, it exists. Then do you do that and just keep the human instinct for wanting to eat meat, or do we work on trying to, you know, this question still, and I mean, we talked about it in other circumstances like climate change here, but it goes down to personal things as well. Whether trying to get, you know, or it goes to, you know, do you take certain medication in order to get rid of urges for things, you know, versus try to rid yourself of those feelings.
Yeah, well, I've got nothing wrong, you know, against technology as such. And, you know, you talked about the human urge to eat meat. What I think that is a particular kind of taste for something that chews in a certain way or tastes in a certain way. And there's nothing wrong with that urge at all. What's wrong with it is when we satisfy it by maltreating animals and contributing to climate change. And, you know, I talk about this in the Why Vegan book that's just out now. So I think that's fine. I think we should use that technology to get as many people away from eating meat as possible. It's not as if they have an urge to make animals suffer or even to accelerate climate change. They don't. It's just that that's a byproduct of this particular evolved taste that not all humans, but many humans have for meat. And if we can satisfy that in a way that doesn't have the bad consequences of eating meat today, that's great. I absolutely would welcome that.
Yeah. I mean, I love it. I love looking at new types of sort of agri-tech, you know, whether vertical farms, which I really love and am involved with, or looking at vegan leather, or I mean, this stuff is really exciting to me to see, you know, technological progress, not because I don't think people are capable of being vegans, but probably I think that most people will not be, you know? So, you know, I look to technological solutions because I become a bit, I feel more pragmatic about the idea if I were to present them with something that tastes the same. It's an easier move.
Absolutely. You know? And you know, that's such a huge thing. I mean, at the moment, there's something like maybe 50 billion chickens in factory farms living miserable lives. And, you know, the animal movement has been trying to stop that for a long time. But essentially, it's made very limited progress, and particularly, it's booming in countries like China, where the animal movement has no hold really in terms of stopping that. But if we could stop that because we can grow chicken in the lab and it's safer and cleaner and cheaper, that'll wipe it out. And, you know, that would be an incredible reduction in the vast quantity of suffering that factory farming is causing.
I think all these things connect to me. It's like, where do I put my energy? And I think that feels like something that if it's on the verge of technologically scaling, it exists not at a scalable level. Well, let's figure out how to scale it. Or if we could find the right geoengineering solution for climate change, let's scale it, because people aren't going to, maybe you do carbon taxes, but as I said, people aren't going, we're disempowered, even if we wanted to, as individuals, make the hugest of difference. So I tend to lean towards, well, maybe as an individual, you know, I'm not the smartest guy. I don't have a background in that particular technology. Maybe it's something that I could actually make, even as an individual, a bigger difference in. It's worth thinking about both ways. And not taking the heat off of us to make decisions either.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is the way to go if we possibly can. And you know, there are so many of these issues. I geoengineering worries me a bit more because of the risks involved. I don't see any risk in producing lab-grown chicken or lab-grown fish is another thing that people are working on, and we are overfishing the oceans, yes, devastating vast numbers of fish, all of which are dying miserably, even if we don't control their lives, but we certainly inflict miserable deaths on them. So, you know, these are technologies that have incredible potential for improving the world.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well, Kai, you know, I just want to thank you so much for coming on. And if nothing else, you know, I think that, you know, conversations like this, and hopefully if anybody listens to this, keeps us thinking about what we can do, and also just, you know, realizing that others out there are too.
So, I mean, I mentioned, I think, the life you can save and the importance of finding the most effective nonprofit organizations to deal with issues. And I think that's something that a lot of people who've made money out of the tech side of things have been aware of.
Well, I wish you were here with me.
That would certainly be better in some respects now, yes.
I get your point, but it still doesn't... And I can't, you know, there's sort of these senses that I'm looking around the room. I'm hearing people walk by. You have this noise behind you. We're not quite experiencing it together. Well, thank you so much,
Peter. All right, you're welcome.